Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on a profitable servant when we come back. You know, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Well, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, things like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes and credit cards, debt and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin versus clad coin or paper currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money versus gold. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us, that you and I, to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and our politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. These politicians knew that they would have to take our gold and silver away from us in order to subjugate a free people. So, they took the gold and silver away back in 1933 to destroy our property rights under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we're going to have to first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. If you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and best of all, it's free. Doesn't cost anything to take a look. So why don't you call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. All right, now once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's talk about the profitable servant. You've probably heard of the unjust steward if you went to Sunday school, and you've probably heard of the unprofitable servant. So let's take a look at what is a profitable servant, because right now, if you're living in the United States of America, in fact, you could probably be living anywhere in the world, to be facing unemployment. And it's kind of scary. I can remember being unemployed a time or two. It's a chilling experience when the boss says, "No, by the way, we won't need you next week," and they give you your final check, and you walk out the door, and you know that on Monday morning you don't have a job. That's kind of a scary feeling. One time a guy told me, he said, "Well, I was looking for a job when I found this one." And so over the years, I've told you about my Uncle Lyle, and I've told you about about hiring yourself a job and one thing and another. Gaining employment isn't the really tough part. Hanging on to the employment is. You know, when times are good and businesses are hiring, you know, you can walk up, knock on the door, and hire on, and you got a job. And that's been going on in what we call boom times here in the United States. Through the 1990s were relatively good times, boom times. 1980s, relatively good times, boom times. And things weren't all that bad between, say, 9/11, you know, and 2007. You know, people seemed to be working and bringing home a paycheck. But suddenly, starting in December of 2007, we went into recession here in the United States. That's what they're telling us now. That's the official date. And for the last 18 months now, we've been in a recession, which is now nosedived into what is known as a depression. That's where prices of things are going down. And so our government's telling us we've got this terrible deflation going on, and we've got to fight deflation. And we're going to do that with stimulus packages. And we've got all of this brouhaha going on here in our Congress and in our public institutions. And meanwhile, back on the farm, where you and I live, the reality is that in November of 2008 and December and then January of 2009, and now I just saw a number came out yesterday for February. They're expecting 650,000 job losses for February. Well, there was over 600,000 in January, and there was 580,000 in December, and then there was 480,000 in November. And, you know, these are starting to add up to be some real numbers here. And so if you're sitting out there and you've got a job, or maybe you've just lost your job, see, and you're kind of crying the blues and you're going down to draw your unemployment insurance and you don't know where you're going to find another job and the job market's really tough. In the Bible, there's a number of stories and a number of laws, rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices that deal with employment. I don't know if you knew that or not, but the creator of the universe, he anticipated that there'd probably be some people that would work for some other people, and there'd be some unemployment, and there'd be some employment. And so he wrote a couple, three statutes and laws here that deal with that. So I thought maybe I'd dig some of those out for you. See, I'm not unemployed. I'm fully employed. I'm overemployed. I have more work than I know what to do with or to shake a stick at. Been that way for the last 25 years. I practice a little different program than the average Joe Sixpack does, and I would submit to you that that's probably why I've got more employment than I know what to do with. Now, most people are either underemployed. I say most now. I'm talking about the people now that are looking for more employment or that are unemployed or that have been laid off and so on. And that's a sizable number of people. So most of these people now that are out here in the marketplace and on the broad scale of things are employed and they're working, and that's 90% of people. Now about 10% of the people out there, and then there are some numbers that tell us there's about 20% of the workforce out there are unemployed. Or they're underemployed. And they've got some numbers that cover that. If we were keeping statistics the way we were back in the 1930s, if we were counting people the way we did there in place of these hedonic numbers that they're giving us now, the unemployment rate would be pushing 20% here in the United States. But we don't count like that. We've got a different way of counting so that it makes the unemployment numbers look better. See, the unemployment rate's only 7%. It's not 20. But you got a lot of PhDs working in Starbucks selling coffee. Now, those people really don't want to be selling coffee at Starbucks. They'd rather be working in the university over here, using their talents and skills and abilities for something that they've trained for. But they can't find work. They can't find a job in their field, so they have to do something else. So they're driving taxi cabs, or they're working, you know, in some service industry, and we call those people underemployed. They've got a job, they're maybe working part-time or something like that, but they're underemployed. All right, now, if you're one of those, let's see if we can't figure out a way for you to become fully employed. I don't know what you want to do. I'm one of those that's fully employed. And now, with depression coming up upon us, we're expecting rates of unemployment in this country that'll approach 40%. I don't know if you've seen any numbers like that out there, but I see the various and sundry numbers coming across my desk. How bad is this going to get? They think it's going to be worse than the 1930s. And I'm one of those that subscribes to that idea. I think that that's probably about true. And in Argentina, back in 2002, 3, 4, long in there, when they went through their economic collapse, the last time they went through an economic collapse, those Argentines and South American countries, they seem to go through this regularly. So they're much more experienced than we Yankees are. But the last time they went through this, their unemployment rate spiked to 62%. Can you imagine that? 38% of people are working. 62% of people are unemployed. And then they turned that around. I don't know what their unemployment rate is now, but they got that thing turned around in 04, 5, 6, 7. You know, things were going along pretty good, and I guess they're probably deteriorating rapidly now. But the moral of the story is that nothing's forever. And just because you lost your job here last week or last month or last year, doesn't mean that that's the end of the world for you. You know, the life goes on. 1933 came and went, 1935 came and went, 1940 came and went, and life went on, you know. Now, the quality of life or your standard of living may take a hit. You know, you might be living poorer now than you were a year ago or 5 years ago, or maybe you're living as well as or better than. But it kind of fluctuates. It goes up, it goes down, one thing or another, and life goes on. And then we look back over time. Boy, those depression years were really rough. I can remember talking to my Uncle Lyle and Uncle Buster and Aunt Bessie and Granny and so on. And they all had stories to tell about the Great Depression, you know. They all had stories to tell about the Great War, you know, back in 1917, 1918, and the flu epidemic. You know, they survived it. They lived through it. And then they all had their stories to tell. And us young kids, you know, we'd sit around and listen to these stories. Wow. Woo, boy, that was really bad. That was really tough. And old Granny and Granddad, they were really tough, and they survived that, and they lived through it. Nobody'd want to have to go through something like that if they could possibly avoid it. But, you know, people seem to repeat their mistakes, and this goes on and on and on. Never seems to level out and change anything. So for those of us then that are here in the real world, we have to face the prospects that you could lose your job. And if you're sitting out there and you're kind of nervous about that, I can tell you how to hang on to your job. I know exactly. I'm an old-timey employer. Not only am I an old-timey employee, but I'm an old-timey employer. I've been hiring people and firing them and dealing with wage earners and business and payrolls, you know, for many, many years. I quit, you know, a long time ago. I'm not doing that anymore, but I've done it in the past. And I know what employers are looking for. So I know what your boss wants out of you. And furthermore, I know who it is that gets the axe first and who it is that's going to get the axe last. So if you want to be the guy that gets the axe last, then listen up. And I'll tell you what it is that your employer is looking for. And if you could deliver to your employer what it is that he's looking for, you'll be the guy that gets axed last. Maybe not at all. But if you're not giving your employer what it is he's looking for, then you're going to be one of the first to go. And if you've already been laid off, then you're one of those first to go. You're not the, you know, if the company's still in business and they're still producing product and they're still out there buying, selling, and trading in the marketplace, and you've been laid off, then that ought to send you a pretty strong signal that you were not the most valuable employee in that company. Because you can rest assured that before they gave you the axe, they evaluated you. They said, is this guy Tom over here now, is he expendable? If we let Tom go, is that going to impact on our business? And they came to the conclusion that by letting you go, Tom, that it was going to improve their bottom line, increase their profitability, and that by letting you go, it was going to be good for their business. And so they let you go. And you're sitting out here in the unemployment line saying, hey, how come they let me go? Has it ever occurred to you that you were an unprofitable servant? So what is a profitable servant anyway? Well, let's take a look here in the scripture and run through a couple of three of these parables. Parables here in the Bible. There's a parable here in Matthew chapter 20 called the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. So I thought, let's go to the Bible and let's take a look at a real wild card in labor and labor relations. And boy, I'm telling you, this God here in the Bible, this guy is the wildest wild card you have ever heard of in your life. This guy practices unfair labor practices. And I also practice unfair labor practices and gets me into trouble more often than you could believe. And so, fortunately for all of us, we have the government and we have the Department of Labor. And we have unions in this country to protect us from these kinds of unfair labor practices that you see in the Bible. But, you know, we ought to take a look at some of these unfair labor practices so that we can see better how to deal fairly with our laborers. Listen to this. This is really wild. It starts in verse 1. It's chapter 20 of Matthew. And here's an example of one of the unfair labor practices that the labor unions and the Department of Labor have corrected. It's fortunate for all of us, and fortunately, that our government has stepped in to protect us from unfair labor practices that you'll find, for example, in the Bible. It's fixing God's mistakes. Listen up. He says, for the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour, and he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And so he said to them, well, go you also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. And again he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour, and he did likewise. Well, about the 11th hour, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he went out and he found others standing idle, and he said to them, well, why are you people standing idle here all day long in the marketplace? And he said, they said unto him, because no man has hired us. And he said to them, well, go you also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall you receive. So when even was come, the end of the day, 6 o'clock, the Lord of the vineyard said unto the steward, well, call all of the laborers together, and give them their hire, pay them off, beginning from the last unto the first. So he said, now, line them up over here, and the guys that came in here at 5 o'clock, you pay them first. The guys that came in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, pay them second. The guys that came in about noon, pay them third. Guys that came in at 9 o'clock in the morning, you pay them fourth. And then the people that came here at 6 o'clock in the morning, worked a full 12-hour day, you pay them last. And he did that. And so when they lined up over there, they that came in the 11th hour received every man a penny. So the guys that showed up at 5 o'clock, worked 1 hour, received one penny, a full day's pay. How do you like that? Boy, talk about a good guy. Now, picture this, you know, here you are, you're the employee, and you went out and you just worked an hour, And the boss doesn't pay you for just an hour. He pays you for the full 8-hour day. God, you'd love him, wouldn't you? But when the first came, the guys that had worked 12 hours, they supposed that they should receive more. But they likewise received every man a penny. And when they received it, they murmured against the good man of the house. You see, when the guys that had worked for the full 12 hours through the heat of the day, they figured, well, if those guys are going to get paid a penny for 1 hour's work, can you imagine how much we're going to get? But they only got a penny. Talk about an unfair labor practice now. So they went to the shop steward, and they filed a grievance. Shop steward then took it to the committee. Then they took it up to the union. The union took it up to the management. And then there's this big brouhaha going on here. So can you just picture what would happen here if you did this down on the docks? I mean, they're not going to allow that, are they? So they murmured against the good man of the house, saying, "These last have wrought but 1 hour, and you have made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, and then he said, "Friend, I do you no harm, and I've done you no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with my own? Is your eye evil because I am good? So the last shall be first, and the first last, because many are called, but few are chosen." All right, let's analyze that one for a minute. When we're dealing with property and property rights in opposition to commerce and commercial privilege, there's a difference in the way property is dealt with over commerce and commercial privilege. When we're out in the marketplace and we have a business license and we're working in the public sector under a restraint, that is, congressional mandate, Congress enacts laws, then we sign up with a business license and we go out into the marketplace and we buy, sell, and trade. And maybe we have a union contract like General Motors. Or maybe we're a United Airlines and we have stewards and stewardesses and we have pilots and co-pilots and flight engineers and baggage handlers and all these people. And there's thousands of these people and they're represented by unions. And the workplace is regulated and governed by the Department of Labor. And they pass down rules and regulations and so on. That's a form of doing business. But then there's another form of doing business, and it's called property. And when you own something, it's governed by thou shalt not steal property. Thou shalt not steal. And so here's the householder who's practicing property and property rights, and what we call contract. So in Article 1, Section 10 of your federal contract here in the United States, there's a clause in there that says government is prohibited from impairing the obligation of contracts. All right, so let's put that one on for a minute. I come up to you and I say, "Hey, Bob, I'd like to pitch you a deal here. I'm pitch you an offer. It's called a tender offer." And I say, "How would you like to come and work for me? And if you'll come and work for me, I will pay you this amount of goods and services, or this amount of this, that, or something else. Doesn't have to be money. I know I could pay you in honey. You come work for me in my vineyard, and I will pay you 5 gallons of honey for the day's work." Another guy could come up to me, and we'd work out a deal, and I'd say, "I will pay you 5 gallons of manure for a day's work." And he agrees with me. And the third guy comes up and we work out a deal. And I say, "You come work for me and I will give you 3.5 gallons of horse urine." At the end of the day, one man comes up and I give him his 5 gallons of honey. Second guy comes up and I give him 5 gallons of horse manure. Third guy comes up, I give him 3.5 gallons of horse urine. Have I wronged any of these people? Isn't that what we contracted for? Isn't that what we agreed to? Isn't that what Article 1, Section 10 is all about? Prohibiting government from impairing, interfering with our right to contract? That's what property and property rights are all about. Now, in an economy, we do business in a little different way. We do business with dollars. And the government makes those dollars. And then we sign a business agreement. It's called a business license. And sign up to the rules and regulations passed out by this business entity called the Congress of the United States or the Legislature of Missouri or wherever you're working. And so they spell out that you have to have a minimum wage. And now the minimum wage here in Missouri, I think, is $6.80 an hour. So if you came here to work for me, I couldn't hire you for 5 gallons of honey or 5 gallons of horse manure. The law prohibits that. The law impairs our obligation of contract. So sometimes people come here and they want to work. And I tell them, well, you can't work here because, you see, you are in a guardian ward relationship with your master, the United States of America, and you have a Social Security number. And I can't hire you. I can't pay you $6.80 an hour. Because if I did that, I would become an employer. And I don't want to become an employer. I don't want that burden. I don't have a business license. And oftentimes people, they don't understand that, and so I don't explain it to them. I just say, I'm sorry, I don't have any work. I don't want to hire you. Now, I can contract with you. I mean, if you walked up to me, let's try it this way. You walk up and you say, well, I'm looking for work. And I say, well, I'm not looking for a worker. And you might say, now listen, I can see out there in your woods that you've got a lot of work to do. And I'd say, you're right, and I've got a lot of work to do. I got a fence over there I'd like to build. And it's all entangled in brush. And so maybe you'd say to me, well, I'll clear all the brush off of that fence from here over to there yonder. And if you will pay me $300 to do that, I'll do that for you. That's called a contract. And you would be called a contractor. Now, I could engage in that kind of activity. I could contract with you. But without a business license and without following all the rules and regulations of the economy and the Congress, I couldn't employ you. See, because I'm not really equipped as an employer. And so, as a result of that, sometimes people, they get kind of upset with me, and they say, Gordon, you're running some kind of an unfair labor practice. Well, hell, I wouldn't deny that. Because I'm like the guy here in this householder story over here. I'm prepared to contract with you, pay you what's right, or pay you what I agree to, but if I don't agree to it, I don't think I'm going to pay you. And, of course, sometimes one guy gets a better deal than the next guy, and the next guy gets a little better deal than the last guy, and so pretty soon they say, hey, this is an unfair labor practice over here. Nothing unfair about it. It's a private contract. This is what you agreed to. And in Numbers chapter 30, God says, you know, what proceeds out of your mouth can't return again. You know, once you've signed up and made an agreement, you know, then that's what you're stuck with. And you ought to fulfill your agreement. So there's the story of the parable of the vineyard. A little story here of an unjust labor practice. And as I said a little earlier, fortunately, we've come along and fixed God's mistakes. We've spent a lot of time here in the United States of America fixing God's errors. Now we've got this great depression of the 21st century around our necks, and people are kind of nervous. They're reporting back that they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs. And yeah, you ought to be afraid of losing your job, because that's what's coming down the pike, all right. How high will unemployment go? I don't know. But they're talking 40%. And based upon the numbers from the last time, based upon the numbers that I'm seeing now, I would concur with that. I think 40% employment's coming. But I want to point out something. Did you know that there's no unemployment in the marijuana, cocaine, and the heroin business? None. Out in the free marketplace, and I'm not sitting here advocating drugs and drug usage. I just want to point out that there's a free marketplace out there. And in the free marketplace, there's no unemployment. None. Those people are entrepreneurs and they're making money. And there's no shortage of marijuana, cocaine, or heroin, or methamphetamines, or anything else. And those people working in the free marketplace don't get price supports. They don't get any TARP funds. They don't have any benefits coming from government at all. Now, the people that are complaining are people like General Motors and the United Auto Workers, who are in a regulated, controlled, legal, above-board, government-sanctioned business that doesn't work. And those people are afraid of losing their jobs, and those companies are being bailed out, and you taxpayers out there are ponying up your labor, your money, to bail those businesses out. Has it ever occurred to you that maybe, there's another business model out there that is superior to the business model that we've been following in this country, and indeed around the world? Well, you hang on, and we'll be talking about that business model that works, the business model that comes from the Ten Commandments, right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, at least to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I started off and I said, I know what employers are looking for in an employee. And if you could furnish what it is that your boss wants from you, you'll be the last guy to go. So I'm going to tell you a couple of 3 stories here. So get your pen and paper out. Let me tell you how to do this. Your employer wants to make a profit off of you, and he wants a profitable servant. But I'm not sure that the average Joe Sixpack American knows what profitable means. Profitable. You probably have a concept in your mind as to what profitable is, but maybe that isn't exactly what your boss has in mind. Have you ever thought about that? So let's take a look at the average Joe six-pack working on the job. One time I had a job at the Earl Sherman Company building fire engines. God, it was a wonderful job. I loved it. I looked forward to going to work. I liked my job so well, I always arrived early. That's the difference between people that go to work because they have to and people that go to work because they want to. And many people are in what we call dead-end jobs. They really don't like the work that they're engaged in. I think that's a mistake. You may be saying, well, the reason that I'm a stewardess on an airline is because the pay is good. I hate the work. I hate what I'm doing. I don't like flying in airplanes, and I don't like being a waitress in the sky, but it pays better than it does down at Tommy's Diner. So a stewardess is, in reality, or used to be, a waitress. You know, they served meals on the airplane and drinks and one thing and another, you know, cocktail hostess. And they got paid, you know, fair to middling well, at least I thought they did. And sometimes people don't like their work. And I hear people once in a while, they'll say, God, I hate my job, but I'm there because of the pay. Well, if that's the case, then there's this old adage that says, you know, if you like your work, you'll enjoy life more, even if you make less money. Now, the truth of the matter is, when you're making $10,000 a year, you're going to spend it all anyway. You're not going to save any of that. And if you make $20,000 a year, you're not going to save any of that. You're going to spend it all. And so the more money you make, the better you live. You just live in a bigger house, and you drive a bigger, better car, you know, more expensive car. All cars have four wheels, and all houses have roofs, and so the roof keeps the rain off of you. The rich man living in the penthouse in New York, he's keeping the rain off of him in trappings that are maybe a little better than yours, but it serves the same purpose. So the moral of the story is, you know, if you like the work that you're engaged in, I think you'll be happier at it, and you'll do a better job, and you'll probably keep your line of work a whole lot longer than you will if you're working at something you don't like. That's just an aside. But, you know, going on to the next step here at the Sherman Company, I arrived early. Now, it was a union job, and you punched in, you know, at 8 o'clock, and you did your, you went out and did your thing, and you did your job. And then at 10 o'clock, there was a 15-minute coffee break, and then you took off at noon, 30 minutes for lunch, and then at 12:30 you went back to work. And then at 2 o'clock, the coffee wagon came around again, and you got another 15-minute break. And then you worked until 4:30, and then about 15 minutes after 4, there was a warning buzzer. And then you'd pick up all of your tools and take your tools back to the tool room and clean up and sweep up and finish up your job. And then you'd punch out at 4:30 when the bell rang. And then you'd go home. Now, out of that work day, you're starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, okay, until 4:30 in the afternoon. And most people would say, well, see, that's an 8-hour day, okay, 8 hours, HR, 8-hour day. Now, did you work 8 hours that day? No, not at all. You see, from 8 o'clock when you punched in down here at the office until you got out to your work site, it would take you about 15 minutes to get to your work site, get your tools out, and get set up to go to work. It takes you about 15 minutes. Then you're going to work from that point. It takes you about 30 minutes to get into the swing of things, you know, to look at the blueprints and take a look at what's going on around you and start actually doing something. So by 9 o'clock, you know, you're actually producing something. So from 9 to 10, for about 1 hour, you're actually at your peak of production. You're fresh for the day, and now you're on the job. You've been here for 2 hours, and at 2 hours, 10 o'clock, here comes the coffee wagon. We get a 15-minute break. So we go out, and we have our coffee, 15 minutes, and then we come back. And now we got to figure out, well, where did we leave off? Well, that takes 5 or 10 minutes to figure out where you left off, and you're chit-chatting with the boys, and pretty soon you get back into the swing of things, and it takes you maybe half an hour, and you get back to cooking. And now for about an hour and a half, you're very productive again. So you've had one productive hour from about 9 to 10, and now you've got an hour and a half that's very productive from about 10:30 to noon. All right, so far you got 2.5 hours of good productive labor in. You've been here 4 hours, and an hour and a half of it's been used for coffee breaks, punching in, getting started, getting your tools together, figuring out where you left off last. Now you take your break for lunch, so you get through with lunch, you come back at 12:30, you got the same problem that you always have. First thing happens, well, where do we leave off? And how do we get started again? Takes you about 5, 10, 15 minutes, and pretty soon you're back into the swing of things. But now you're going to work for about an hour and a half, and at 2 o'clock, here comes the coffee wagon again. So at 2 o'clock, you're taking your 15-minute break, and then, you know, you got the same problem getting back to work again. And then this goes until 4:15, and at 4:15, you got to clean up your work area. You got to sweep up, take your tools back to the tool room, and that's 15 minutes that's shot. Now let's add up our 15 minutes for first coffee break, 15 minutes for second coffee break, 15 minutes for cleanup. Now, you're on the payroll for this 45 minutes, see? Cleanup, 15 minutes. And then there was this downtime that you're suffering from getting started. You know, you had to go to the tool room, pick up your tools, take them out to the work site, look at the plans, and get things into operation. And so I'm going to put 15 minutes down there. Now, that's 4 15-minute periods, and that's very conservative. You know, it takes time to walk to the coffee wagon, takes time to walk back from the coffee wagon. It's not a 15-minute break. It's more like a 20 or 25-minute break. 5 minutes out, 5 minutes back, 15 minutes off on our coffee break. All right, do you ever stop to figure out what this is costing your boss? And this is in the union contract. So the boss now has to pay you for about 1 hour a day, and if you're making the average wage here in the United States, blue-collar welders and electricians and carpenters, $17.58 an hour. You're getting $17.58 an hour. It's about 30 cents, round numbers, you round it off, 30 cents a minute. So if we pay you for 30 cents a minute for 1 hour, you know, that's about $18. So your paycheck, you know, every day, has 1 hour in there that's totally non-productive. But it's all right because we're billing it out to the customer. Now, when you get into economic slow times like we're in today, then there's other guys out there that are working for less or trying to sharpen their pencils and do the job. This is called competition. So your boss now is faced with competition. Some of his customers stop buying from him. They're out buying from somebody else. You're losing market share here, Tom. Now, your boss decides that he's had about a 10% loss in business. He's got 30 employees, and his business is down by 10%. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that he's going to shave off 3 workers. Ah, it's worse than that. Watch what I'm going to do. See, as an employer, if I'm going to shave off 3 workers, I'm going to reorganize our work schedule, and I'm going to shave off 6 workers for my 10% loss in business, and I'm going to spread that onto the other 24 workers. Say I got 30 in my plant, and I'm going to cut off 6. See, I'm going to actually turn this to my advantage because I'm an unjust steward. I'm an unjust employer that's using unfair labor practices. I mean, that's just the way life is. Kids, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. And so 6 of you people out of the 30 that are working here in this plant are going to be culled out. Now, how does the boss determine who he's going to cull out? Does he take a pair of dice and throw the dice and see what numbers come up? Does he cast lots to see who it is that's going to be terminated? Well, in a union shop, what they do is they take the last guy hired as the first guy out. They call it seniority. And so the boss is kind of locked in. He doesn't have a choice as to who he can keep and who he can't. So he uses numbers, and he says, let's get rid of six of them and spread the work around the rest of them over here. See, changes the work rules based upon the last contract. And six of you get the axe. If it's a non-union shop, and this guy, this boss now, he has latitude. He can let anybody go that he wants. He can take some guy that's been there for 10 years and let him go. And a guy that has just been hired on in the last 3 weeks, he could keep that guy. And you know how he's going to make his selection, don't you? Well, which one of these guys is producing the most? Now, if you've got a union contract and you've got coffee breaks and you got tool rooms and all these work rules and one thing and another, you're kind of stuck with them. And so other companies, they follow these same work rules. And even if it's a non-union shop, they'll tend to follow this non-union shop will follow union work rules. It's just kind of a carryover. I used to do that in my non-union shop, and I used union rules. It's kind of the standard in the industry over here. But when I was going to let somebody go, you know, I'd analyze this guy and figure out, how much money does this guy make me? Well, let me tell you a little story over here. I was running a furniture manufacturing company, and I had an operation down here called the mill. The mill. And down in the mill, a truckload of lumber would come in, and it would carry about 30,000 board feet. Truckload comes in, 30,000 board feet, and 2x10 pine. Now, some of the boards will have knots in them. And some of the boards will have the knots, dry knots, had fallen out, and so there's a hole in the board. Some of them would have pitch seams in them. Now, we're making waterbed frames, and so there's some long boards. Take a 16-foot board, and you'd cut a 7-foot side rail out of that board. Now you got 9 feet left. And so, the 9 feet that's left, you take a look at that, and it's got a little bit of a pitch seam down the side of it, and it isn't going to make a 7-foot sideboard, but you could cut it into, four 23¾-inch Sun Valley shelves. Because the pitch seam isn't important when it's used in the shelf of a headboard. See? And so you'd have 12 inches left over. Now that 12 inches that's left over you could use for the little corner shelf, let's say, in the Aspen headboard. And that would give you 100% cut out of that 16-foot board less the saw curve. See how that goes? 7-foot board. Now, when you're making up an order, you know, the plant superintendent comes in and he's looking at parts for various products that you have in your product line. And so he comes down with what they call a cutting list. And today, he gives the sawyer in the mill, he gives him a cut list, and it says that he needs 67-foot side rails. He needs 36-foot end rails. He needs 320 Sun Valley shelves at 23¾ inches. He needs 60 12-inch Aspen shelves. In other words, he goes down and he tells the sawyer down here, now, here's what we need in order to keep our production going and so on. So the sawyer takes a look at that list. And now over here are these raw boards, see, just units of lumber sitting over here. And he pulls these boards off of here, see. Now, the sawyer down here, in some cases, we've had as high as 33% loss. When we get through with this 30,000 board feet of lumber, a full 33% of it goes into the scrap bin to be hauled off to the landfill. You know, pitch seams, you know, you can't use for side rails and one thing and another. Now, there are other guys that would work in the mill as a sawyer, and their total cut would be about 10% loss. Now, that's quite a bit. You know, that's 23% difference. Now, let's run through some numbers here. Let's suppose you're an employee, and I'm going to hire you, and I'm putting you in my mill down here, and I'm going to pay you $6 an hour. And you're working away down here cutting things, and, you know, you're pretty good at it. You can work the saw, and you can cut the board, and that's what we want you to do. But when you get the mill list, you take a 16-foot board, and you cut it into 12-inch and 24-inch shelves. And then when you get through cutting the shelves, then you have to cut 6- and 7-foot end rails and side rails. But as you're cutting through, you find out that this board over here has a pitch seam. You could have cut that pitch seam into the 12- and 24-inch boards, but you didn't. You took the best lumber and you cut that up into shelves, and now you got a 16-foot board, but you can only get a 7-foot side rail out of it. And so the rest of it's scrap. And so you throw that in the scrap because you can't use it. Now, you know, you may be sitting there saying to yourself, well, my goodness, surely people wouldn't do that, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they? I wish they didn't, but I'm telling you, as an employer, yeah, that's exactly what they do. You go out onto a job site. I had an old contractor one time tell me, he says, you know, you can have a carpenter come out here, and when he gets through with this building project over here, you'll have to call the BFI guys to come out here with a second scrap container to haul all the scrap away. You can hire another carpenter, and you can haul his scrap away in a wheelbarrow. So, yeah, it's really true that not all carpenters are equal. There's some carpenters out there, you know, they go through a lot of wood. And there's other carpenters out there, you know, that can get more use out of that wood. You get a 4x8 sheet of plywood, you know, and depending upon how you cut it and what you take out of it and what scraps left over and what you can use for something else, you know, oftentimes a carpenter on a union job, he just goes out and gets a new sheet of plywood. He's not going over here and use something out of the scrap pile over there that would work just as well. What does he care? He's not paying for it. Now, that makes a lot of difference. Now, to give you the numbers over here, if you took a truckload of lumber and had a 33% waste, then the loss is $10,240. It's $600 a thousand. So you got $18,000 worth of lumber over here. 33% of that's $10,240. Now, you're paying this guy $6 an hour. He goes through the 30,000 feet. He's a fast sawyer. And he cuts this up in a 40-hour week. At the end of 40 hours, he's gone through the whole truckload of lumber, cut it up, sent it out to the various departments in the plant. You could take another guy over here, and he's slower. It takes him 2 weeks to cut a whole truckload of lumber. So, you know, you'd sit there and say, well, which guy would I rather have? The guy that has a 10% waste and takes 2 weeks, or the guy that does it in 1 week and has a 33% waste? Because boys and girls, you'll have in the scope of your operation, you'll have sawyers that do both. Well, from the employer's point of view, the guy that takes 2 weeks costs me $480 in labor, and the guy that does it in 1 week costs me $240 in labor. So he costs me twice as much. And I've heard this, I don't know how many times I've heard, yeah, but you know, time is money, boss. Time is money. And I'm fast. Yeah, that's right, Tom. You're fast. Twice as fast as Bobby over here. But Bobby over here, when he saves that 23%, has a net profit on my bottom line of $8,000. He saves me $7,960. He gets more lumber out. It's true, it cost me an extra $240, but I'm happy to spend $240 in labor to save $7,960 in wood. So I got to tell you, boys and girls, on the bottom line, if I have to choose between these two guys, I'm going to choose the guy that saves me the $7,960 every single time. I'm going to keep the carpenter that goes over to the scrap pile and uses the scrap over there and is concerned about saving me $32 on that sheet of plywood. And that's just where life's at. Now, if you tuck that away in your heart, now let's try this coffee break thing again. Do you know how much that coffee break costs your boss? At 30 cents a minute, a 15-minute coffee break costs him $4.50. Honest to God, do you people out there believe that your boss wants to pay you $4.50 to eat a donut and drink coffee? Do you think that's why he's got you hired here? Do you think that's why you come to work every day so you can drink coffee and eat donuts? Is that your purpose in life? Do you believe that? Well, everybody else does. It's in the contract. Let me tell you how I handle it. When the coffee break wagon would come, you know, the rest of the guys would drop all their tools and they'd take off. I stayed right there on the job. I didn't drink coffee and I didn't eat donuts. So I gave my boss, Mr. Sherman, my 15 minutes every morning and afternoon, my 30 minutes a day. After all, he's paying me. In those days, I was getting $3.28 an hour at the top of my field. But anyway, that's years and years ago. Today, it'd be $17.58. Well, I noticed that Mr. Sherman, every once in a while, would be walking through the plant. And everybody else is up here telling jokes and drinking coffee and having a good time. And here's little Georgie Gordon. He's back here. You know, I'm an old farm kid, you know, so I'm back over here. And I'm doing my work. And he said, well, how come you're not up there drinking coffee? I said, well, sir, I don't drink coffee. That's number one. And number two, you didn't hire me to drink coffee. You hired me as a welder. And I'm back here doing what you hired me for. And he smiled. He's an old man. He smiled and he said, well, yeah, that's right, son. That's what I hired you for. Now, I got to tell you, that was a union shop. And that didn't get anything. Because when layoffs came, I was one of the last guys in and I was one of the first guys to go. But I tucked that away in my heart. You see, I'm pretty sure that if Mr. Sherman had a choice in the matter, he would have kept me over the other guy. But I worked in a union shop, and I got to tell you, I played the game by union rules. And as a result of that, my extra work meant nothing. I didn't get paid a dime more, didn't get paid a dime less. And when layoffs came, I was the first to go. So that tells us a little piece of the story, working in a union shop and getting paid under the union rules and playing the game. And there's more rules to come, and there's more ways to hang on to your job. And next time we'll tell you about International Harvester and how to hang on to that job. Meanwhile, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to remind you here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.